Teach me your ways, O Lord, and I will walk in your truth. Give me an undivided heart that I may fear your name.
Interface. Not the same questions, not the same answers.
Hello and welcome to Interface, an examination of Christian perspectives on thought, faith, and culture with Adam Ayers, the pastor of Disciples Church and the founder of the Stoa Foundation. Joining us in the studio today are Chris Holowaty, Jay Gaddis, and Jennifer Vallott. And this is Tom Dunn. I'm filling in for Brad Johnson, who is out of town. As many of you know, Halloween is a hot topic among the evangelical Christian community. Many believe that it's downright evil and to be gotten rid of at all costs, and some believe that it's not that big of a deal and it's something to be enjoyed, and there's many different opinions in the middle as well. So we thought we would talk about it. For myself, I guess it really depends on what an individual's personal conviction is. For some people, having a costume party where you dress up as your favorite TV character or your favorite, you know, historical character or whatever, and getting together with friends is a wonderful thing. Time for fellowship, a time for celebration, a joyous experience. Other people feel that to take part in the Halloween experience in any way, whether it's dressing up at this time of year in a costume, or trick-or-treating with your kids, or essentially taking part in any way at all, is somehow feeding into demonic forces, or somehow feeding into that which is anti-Christian. People take the position that the idea of All Hallows Eve, sort of the concept of the powers of evil having a big fling before All Saints Day, that in any way taking part in that is wrong and that Christians should be fasting and praying for that whole night. So lots of different opinions about it, and I'd like to hear what you guys have to say. So Jay, why don't we start with you? What are your thoughts on it? What have people been talking to you about it recently?
I had a discussion recently with a pastoral counselor that I met up at a conference on spiritual warfare. And he had an interesting perspective that I hadn't heard before. He saw it as a pagan ritual, the reenactment of a pagan ritual that, of course, comes out of the traditions in Europe. And that much like there can be consequences when you partake in Holy Communion in an inappropriate way, there can be consequences for taking part in a reenactment of a pagan sacrament, so to speak, whether you are acknowledging or aware of those consequences or not. And so I thought that was a very interesting perspective, and I wondered about, you know, we do hold that there are consequences for taking part in Holy Communion if you take part inappropriately, whether you know that or not. Does that apply to other spheres, non-Christian sorts of things, rituals and celebrations and these kind of things?
How does that make you feel, Jay? What do you think about that?
Well, on one level, that makes sense. But there's something about it, and I don't know how to put it into words, that doesn't seem quite right, that anything we do that might be analogous to some other religious practice would affect us in a negative way. It seems kind of overboard or over the top, you know, that anything I do that is remotely similar to any other religious practice, even if I'm not aware of it, then I could be affected. That seems a bit strange. And the Bible, I mean, from what when I think about the scriptures on that, Paul seems to say that as long as it doesn't bother your conscience, that anything is allowable. You know, that partaking in, you know, meat sacrifice to idols is okay as long as it's okay with your conscience. And if it's not, then don't. And so that's kind of what my first thing that comes to my mind. But then I feel like there's another level of, well, there's participation in actual religious practices, like, say, tarot card reading or something like that, that is forbidden and have consequences whether or not your conscience bothers you or not.
A lot of this is really reminiscent to me of a lot of horror films that I've seen about some object that carries some kind of latent power to it, and some innocent family or an innocent person gets a hold of it or finds it somewhere, and all havoc breaks loose in their lives because of this talisman. Kind of a comedic version of it would be like The Mask with Jim Carrey, you know, where this bumbling guy just finds a mask, but what he doesn't realize is that this mask has power in and of itself to transform and create and make all kinds of change in his life. I don't know that I see that idea really portrayed much in scripture, of objects that we are to fear because of some latent power within it, or because of some kind of curse laid upon it. That seems more of a pop culture idea, but not so much something that I see in the scriptures as being something I'm supposed to get nervous about. If anything, it seems like Paul, in the example that you just cited, seems to remove a lot of the fear of these pagan rituals by going, you know what? They're all empty. So if you don't have a problem with it, if you don't have a problem with meat offered to idols, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the meat. It's fine. Eat it. If you feel okay about it, don't worry about it. It's not nearly as important to worry about some kind of a curse laid upon it. So I don't know if we are to be so concerned about the fact that kids dressing up in costumes and asking for candy from their neighbors, the fact that that resembles or may have even emerged out of some kind of a pagan ritual, I don't know that we as Christians should be all that concerned about a ritual or an object that is supposedly carrying some kind of intrinsic curse or something like that with it.
What's coming to my mind, Chris, is there's a distinction there between Paul talking about eating something that was an object used in a ritual versus my taking part in a ritual. So if we took, say, the example of even communion that we partake in the church, the difference between sitting in the pew during the ceremony, partaking of the elements, or someone who, after the service, takes the bread and the wine home and has lunch. And so I wonder if there is a difference there, and perhaps there are different sets of principles or consequences.
That's an interesting point, Jay, because at what point does the body and blood of the Lord become the body and the blood of the Lord? Is it when it's taken out of the box and put on the communion table? Is it when the preacher walks up to the podium? Is it when he says, Lord, please come? When is it hallowed? And when the service is over, if the person takes it home and eats it, is he then desecrating the body and blood of the Lord? You know, Chris, I would say that I would challenge you in the sense of it would seem in the scriptures that there are certain things that have power in and of themselves. The ark, when it's kept at that person's place in the Old Testament, his family's blessed. When it's kept at the camp of the Philistines, they get tumors or some sort of bodily problem. When Uzzah reaches out and touches the ark, he's torched immediately. And Paul in Corinthians, when he talks about not discerning the body and the blood of the Lord, and it kills you. Somehow in these elements, there is a power. I don't know, maybe I'm reading it wrong, but or the Nehushtan in the Old Testament that Moses sticks up, you look at it and you're saved. His rod, that when he holds it up, Israel's victorious. When he holds it down, they're not. Elijah's cloak, that he hits the water and it parts. Elisha's staff or rod, that when he lays it on the waters or lays it on the face of the dead child. I mean, I don't know. It's just, I hear what you're saying, and I do agree that we're not to be into relics at all. But how do you explain these things?
I guess in response to that, I would say, is there a correlative side to things being cursed that we are supposed to be afraid of? I hear what you're saying about God saying, this is holy and you will not mess with it. Does the devil have the same ability to look at something, whether it's a ritual or an object, and say, this is cursed? And anyone who touches it, or anyone who even mimics this ritual in any way, is also cursed. Do we see that same flip side to it? Because I've heard the same argument about rock and roll, you know, growing up, about how the beat was used in pagan rituals, and therefore it's sinful to have a strong, pronounced beat in music. Now, I thought that was kind of ridiculous, because why would the beat necessarily be cursed? Did the devil somehow have some ability to be able to grab onto something that has been created by God and say, no, this is now permanently and forever for the purpose of evil, and if anyone touches it, they are cursed.
I think we can find a real strong precedent in Scripture that there are such things as dark spiritual powers that are associated with objects. Probably one of the best examples that we find are the magicians of Egypt who oppose Moses. Some traditions, non-biblical traditions, name them as Jannes and Jambres, and Paul quotes that. But the idea is that somehow there are these pagans that have access to a spiritual power that can, in that case, transmute physical matter. Staffs of snakes, you know, tricks that are very real, and yet not to the degree of power to which God imbues items with identification. There's also, it seems in Scripture, an idea that the power of a sacred object or a non-sacred object is really, as it relates, an extension of the person with whom it is associated. Elisha's staff, Paul's kerchiefs, Moses' rod, the ark of Yahweh, who dwells between the cherubim. You see, in each of these, it is an extension of the individual in the same way that your words are an extension of you. That somehow by association with you, and that's really the idea of representative magic in the ancient Near East. That's why when Ezekiel, under the inspiration of the Lord, builds a little representative Jerusalem and makes war against it, that somehow that is efficacious upon Jerusalem. That it actually takes place because it is representative magic. The thing is shown in its presentation, in its icon. The same way with idols. No one really believed that idols were gods per se. But you're right, when the Philistines take the ark in to the temple of Dagon, Dagon is found face down. The idol is. And the next day, you know, after they tip him back up, the next day he's found without his head and his hands. And they're on the threshold, and so the priests of the Philistines never step on the threshold of Dagon. So there's this idea of symbolic battle, almost like chess pieces. And that's an image used often of the divine working on, or the spiritual working on the tangible plane, is that of moving pieces. So there seems to be a reality that there can be contaminated objects or unclean things. You know, touch not the unclean thing. Did you not take the star of your god Remphan, you know, with you into the wilderness? This idea of don't take these things. When Jacob and his family go to meet the Lord, they hide the teraphim underneath the oak tree. They take off their jewelry. These are the kinds of acts that are required in order to purify yourself to meet with Yahweh in the Old Testament, that you remove certain contaminants from you that would be representative of other associations. In some way, I guess it would be something like a wedding ring, that you take off your wedding ring to these other identities if you're going to meet with Yahweh, you know, or engagement ring. So I think we really find both. And the idea is, what is the relative power of the associated articles? It is the relative power of the identities involved with them. So I think for Paul, Paul has such confidence in the presence of the Lord that he says, demons, we know that they're not there. It's not that Paul knows that there are no such things as demons, there are no such things as gods, because he cites it other places that it's offered to demons, and he rebukes demons. It's not that he has no idea of the reality of demons, it's that to him they are irrelevant. Your conscience and the presence of the Lord are sufficient. And there really could be, if there is an idea of the sacredness of an object, something offered to an idol would then be sacred. And it would be participation, whether temporarily removed or not, to be partaking in that, to be eating that meat. In the same way that the bread, the show bread that's left before Yahweh, is then forbidden for anyone else to eat. It's sacred by association with him. But it seems to be that there is a power to ritual in Bible that is extended beyond the intention of the moment. And that once formed, like a curse, it says, is like a bird, you know? That once formed, a curse or a blessing or an item has an innate reality beyond the moment of its forming. I think this is illustrated with Isaac, that even though in a situation of duplicity where he is deceived and he believes that he is giving a blessing to Esau, that blessing is not given to Esau, that blessing is given to Jacob. And there is nothing that he can do, no matter how much intention he musters, to give that blessing now to Esau. It's done, it's over, it's beyond his control, it's gone. He can't pull it back, he can't transfer it, and he can't duplicate it. It's a one-shot cartridge. And so he gives minor blessings that he left out. And that might be something for us to discuss here too, the power of ritual without intention.
I feel that so often we get involved with the theology behind Halloween, Satan versus Christ, and we don't look at the reality of Satan's scheme behind Halloween. And I guess that's where I come, and I kind of look at it from that point of view, in that his idea is to make Halloween fun, make it non-invasive, make it a party, and make it okay so that he can disarm us and not allow us to, because we allow ourselves to think that there is no real problem. There is no real harm in taking part in a day that so long ago was a ritual and was evil. I think that as Christians, we are called not to take part in things that are evil and things that are obviously not of the Lord, whether that be simply dressing up or whether that be passing out the candy, or if you're not a Christian, obviously taking part in a satanic ritual. I think that we falsify the whole idea, though, behind Halloween. Often we mask it as though it is this fun, no harm, no foul holiday. And we dress our kids up as ghosts and goblins and demons without even thinking of the reality that we're dressing our kids up as our enemy, as the one we're supposed to be fighting against, and allowing that to be a part of our children's lives. My question, I guess, is biblically, God tells us to run from evil, yet we embrace it in a holiday.
I hear what you're saying, Jen. However, what comes to mind immediately is that we are to avoid the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life in all forms. And we as a Christian community tend to get up in arms about Halloween because, quote-unquote, it is the enemy's territory. And yet we have no problems at all taking our kids to the mall every weekend for recreation and dressing them up in guest jeans. And yet it would appear from the words of Christ that the fashion of this world, not fashion, but the manner of this world is more of our enemy and more dangerous and more a ploy of Satan, trying to make that which is truly dangerous to our souls innocuous and fun, than is the overt, that the idols at least are recognizable and in some ways can be mocked for their lack of power. And yet the insidious would seem to be to model to our children that we need to worry about tomorrow, when Christ overtly forbids such, to set up savings accounts and IRAs and take them down to look at new cars, to repeatedly talk about their college funds, making it in this world, being successful. When those are the things that Christ over and over again directly addresses. And so we expend all of our energy on an enemy who's already beaten overtly, while swallowing whole the real candy with the poison in it, which is the entire mode of our civilization, by feeding our kids advertisements, which are far more insidious and far more powerful to shape the will and the manner of life and to capture that which is truly worship. I doubt that anybody worships the ghosts, the goblins, and stuff on Halloween, but I think we train our kids to worship that which drives the Mercedes and that which has the corner office with the windows. Because I think the key issue involved is loyalty and worship in that which is rendered as homage to strength an homage to that which has power. And in some ways, in addressing these things as powerful, we do yield to them power. I would say if there is associative evil, it would probably be wise not to touch money. Because the things in which money has been involved, say a $20 bill's lifetime, are probably far more antagonistic to Christian faith, having to do with the worship of that money and the mockery of saying in God we trust on money in which we trust, than would be a Halloween mask. And I think if we're going to demonize the one, we need to demonize at least the other and recognize the power at work behind both.
The one issue that I heard you say that I was thinking about was that you didn't think that anyone celebrated Halloween today. My question to you would be, is Satanism dead?
I think very few are worshiping in their costuming. That is not to say that I don't think that people worship at Halloween. I think that people do worship darkness at Halloween. I don't think that that is exhibited by costuming. I think that there are other ways in which dark stuff happens. And I think that those forces are real and are in opposition to us. And that the enemy does go about as a lion seeking to devour people. And that his teeth have not been pulled. Otherwise, that would be a ridiculous statement. Is Satanism dead? Utterly. Utterly. Because it's based on death. And it's based on something that has no ability to give life, that comes only to steal, kill, and destroy, and take away life, which is actually in Jesus Christ. There is only one religion, I believe, that is alive. And that's because there is only one God who is alive. And that's Jesus Christ and Christianity. And all others are dead, though they seem to have life. And that's the whole point of idols in the first place anyway, that they really are dead, no matter what.
Well, again, we've come to the end of our time here on the show. A lot of the points you all have made, whether objects have power in and of themselves, whether Satan is alive and well and working on planet Earth, to quote somebody's book title, whether certain holidays are bad and to be avoided, whether certain holidays have power, which is to be avoided. Very interesting things that I know I'm going to be thinking about for a while, and I'm sure our listeners out there will be thinking about as well. I also look forward to us talking on our next program, perhaps, about ritual and the powers of ritual and the sacredness of ritual and worship within ritual. I want to thank Adam Ayers, Jay Gaddis, Chris Holowaty, and Jennifer Vallott for being here today. I want to thank Chris Holowaty, our engineer, for making Interface to sound as good as it does. Thanks to Begonia Studios for helping to make Interface possible, and thanks to you for listening.